from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Welcome to Where Y'all Really From, a podcast about Asian Americans in Kentucky. I'm your host, Charlene Buckles, a proud Filipina Kentuckian. Today with us, we have guest Uyên Nguyen. Uyên is a Vietnamese-American social worker and therapist. She's 1.5-generation immigrant, and she's lived in Louisville most of her life. Uyên graduated from Bellarmine University with a double major in foreign languages and international studies in English. After 2 years teaching English in Japan, she returned to the U.S. and started working in the nonprofit world, helping people who have experienced domestic violence, homelessness, and mental illness. She's now a behavioral health consultant at Family Health Centers.
Welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here.
Hi, nice to meet you, or talk to you.
You're fine. And before the show, we talked about this, and it is Uyên, right?
Uyên.
Uyên, yes. And we talked before the show, I'm Filipino, and so we don't have a tonal language, but when I was in Thailand, it was the first time that I realized, and Thai is a tonal language with fine tones, and I realized that I'm tone deaf, I'm pretty sure, and so I apologize so much for not being able to mispronounce your name, but I do feel it's such a beautiful name, and that people need to have that effort to be able to pronounce it because it's so beautiful. Have you had that experience often in your life of people mispronouncing, and how would you deal with that?
I think it's a difficult name even for Vietnamese. So technically it's Uyên, but a lot of Vietnamese say Uyên because you have to, you know, kind of twist your mouth that extra step. There are 3 vowels in my name, which is the maximum combination of vowel you can have in Vietnamese. So even for Vietnamese, it's hard. And then for non-Vietnamese, it's a vowel combination that I haven't heard in any of the languages I know. So it's difficult. And people will usually ask how I pronounce it, and I try. And I appreciate the effort. My full first name is Ngọc Uyên. But when I started working professionally as a social worker in 2012, I dropped the Ngọc and went by Uyên, because it's easier for clients and professionals in the field to remember.
Right.
And most of my Vietnamese friends call me Uyên as well.
So. Okay. I want people to make sure to know that I think we need to reclaim that and make that effort even more and correct me when I fail or if I fail. And because again, it's such a beautiful name, and I feel like we need to just lean into it and make sure that people are making that effort to know us fully, you know, and not have to accommodate. But that's kind of me and where I am in my journey. Of course, with the name Charlene Buckles, it's a whole, we'll just have a therapy session separately about why I went with that name. but anyway, I would like to start each episode. I like to start each episode talking about the title of this podcast. So as you know, as Asian Americans, we are asked that question, where are you from? Where are you really from? We're asked that 1 to maybe 1 million times in our lifetime, right? So can you tell me what kind of emotion or a response, or if there is a response, does that question elicit for you?
It's interesting because when I'm abroad, meaning when I'm not inside the U.S. and people ask me, where are you from? I tell them I'm from the U.S. But when I'm in the U.S. and people ask me, I kind of know where that comes from. So then I say I'm Vietnamese. And sometimes I just say I'm Vietnamese. Sometimes I say I'm from Vietnam. I was born in Saigon, or formerly known now as Ho Chi Minh City. And my family immigrated here when I was 10. So that's where I'm from, Vietnam.
And you openly tell people that, like, if someone were to ask you that at a grocery store, so where are you from? It doesn't resonate with you as offensive. I mean, it sounds like you're just like, okay, well, they're curious, I'm just going to tell them. Or is it something that is there something that gets triggered you? Because I'll be honest with you, when we were talking about the name of the podcast, it triggered me because mm-hmm. growing up, I got asked that all the time, you know, where are you from? Where are you really from? And I would say, I'm from Northern Kentucky. And they're like, no, but where are you really from? Because there's a underlying tone, you know, that they're saying, you're not really from here. You're not from Kentucky. You're not white. So you're not really from Kentucky. And so it triggered something in me. But for you, I mean, it seems like you were saying that, you know, not really, or maybe it does.
Most of the times it doesn't, but there have been times where I sense something malicious in the question. Then I said, well, I'm from Kentucky. and, you know, and I've been with friends who have been very offended by it, especially even when it was asked by, say, another Asian person. It's just like, mm-hmm. well, why are you asking? And some of my friends are born here in the U.S. and they're like, you know, I'm from here. You know, why do you want to know? I think when I'm abroad, it seems that's just an honest curiosity. So I got used to answering that question. So I'm not as easily triggered, I think, by that question.
Mm-hmm. You grew up here in Kentucky, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And so when did you immigrate here from Vietnam?
So I was 10 and my family first came to California. We stayed there for 6 months. And then my dad couldn't find a job. So he had a friend here in Kentucky who worked at Dean's Milk. And so he said, if you come here, I'll help you find a job. And so my whole family moved here. And we've been here since then. So I was in fifth grade when we moved to Kentucky.
How was that transition for you coming from California, which is very, I have a very similar story, you know, where I moved from Manila to California. And then we moved from California to Kentucky, and I was around seven or eight when I moved here to Kentucky. And for me, there was a lot of culture shock, you know, because in Southern California, there were not many white people. I think the first white person that I met was in first grade in California. And then here it was like everyone was white. So how was that transition for you moving from Vietnam to California and California to Kentucky?
I think the language barrier was the biggest shock. I was always terrified of getting lost because I was like, how would I ask for directions? And then when we moved to Kentucky, the area we lived in, which is South Louisville, has a lot of Vietnamese. So I still have that. You know, there were still Vietnamese kids at the school I went to. We had ESL and all the kids in my group were Vietnamese kids. So it didn't seem as big a difference in terms of that. What I missed the most was the food. There are a lot of Vietnamese grocery store, restaurants, food in California versus here. My mom learned to cook a lot of Vietnamese food. A lot more than she used to.
We could have a whole episode on food and nostalgic that feels, you know, the feeling of food and how that taste and those smells just bring back such vivid memories of childhood. And I think that's really interesting that you went into a Vietnamese community here in Kentucky. I mean, again, I just never had that. I was just surrounded by people that were very different. Did you ever feel, or I guess, when was that first time that you felt different? Did you ever feel like you were othered at one point in your childhood, or that first moment when you're like, I'm a minority in Kentucky?
That probably was when I started attending Bellarmine.
Oh, wow.
Which was dominantly white. You know, I remember joking with, you know, one of my classmates that, you know, you would see the same people on the brochure. Like if they want to highlight diversity, you would see the same people.
Yes. Yep.
But the high school that I went to was relatively diverse, I think. And so was my middle school.
in Bellarmine, I mean, and I graduated from Transy, so I absolutely hear that when they ask you, hey, can you do this photo shoot? And I'm like, I'm not a very photogenic person. They're like, no, but we really need you for this photo shoot. And you kind of know where they're getting at. But how is that like, those years at on the Hill at Bellarmine?
I really loved my Bellarmine experience, to be honest, because it was a small classroom setting. I went to a huge high school, so I think my graduating class at Bellarmine was smaller than my graduating class at my high school. And it was a liberal college experience, so I was exposed to a lot of things I was liberalized, to be honest. Because I came from a very traditional Vietnamese family setting, and you respect your elders. The males in the family have more, they have more ability to make decisions. So Bellarmine changed that for me, I think. I did feel lonely. I think there was only one other Vietnamese person in my class.
Yeah.
So it felt lonely in that experience. You know, people were nice and polite. Nobody was ever mean, or if they were, I probably didn't detect it. Although I do remember one time we were talking about affirmative action, and one of my classmates, who got the same scholarship that I did, he pointed out, well, you know, it's likely that you got your scholarship because of affirmative action. And I'm okay with that. And I remember being so angry, but I did not say anything at the time. I worked really hard for this scholarship, you know. So I think that was the only incident that I can recall from my college experience at Bellarmine that felt racist. There were probably others, you know, I don't know. I don't remember.
Yeah. No, I hear that. It's interesting because I'm hearing you say all these stories, and there's like so many points in which you were talking. I was like, that, I know exactly that feeling, you know, being able to have, getting exposed to the quote unquote liberal arts education and feeling, okay, this is totally different from what I'm used to, and these are not necessarily the values in which I was instilled. And there was, for me at least, there was a lot of tension at home because of that, because, you know, I was quote unquote westernized in a sense that that I was constantly questioning my elders, or you know, my grandfather at the time who was living with us, and my father, and even in you know, Filipino culture, it's very much a top down, respect your elders, respect the male figurehead, and there was a lot of tension. Did you feel that when you went home for, you know, the summers or breaks?
Well, I stayed. I lived at home. So initially I had wanted to move away for school. I'd applied to a school in Massachusetts and I got in. But my mom really wanted me to stay in Louisville. And I have an older brother and he didn't move away. So I picked Bellarmine because it was the smaller setting, but also like that was my one way to rebel, like, because he went to rebel, and I'm like, this, I'm at least making my pathway in this, you know, and it turned out to be, you know, a great decision. It's very traditional in that, like, my family is very traditional in that way. My dad had passed away when we were teenagers, so my brother, even though he was only a year and a half older than me, he became the male of the family, and he got to make a lot of the decisions. That's typical in Vietnamese culture, you know.
And right now, and you're okay with that. How do you balance that? That, like, knowing, like, okay, this is the person I want to be, as someone who grew up in Kentucky, or even, you know, having these ideals, and this is a question that I struggle with and ask myself all the time. Like, I have this idea of who I want to be that's not necessarily in line with what my family or what my culture kind of expects of me. How do you balance that for you? Or is it even a question, you know?
My family and I disagree on a lot of things. And I think we do butt heads, and we do have to go our separate way when conversations get heated. And then at the end of the day, we come back to, okay, I love you. And I know that we are different, and we'll leave it as that. You know, like my brother said, many times he's like, you and I are very different. but, you know, we're brother and sister, and I love you. And same things with my mom. You know, there have been conversations about politics and mm-hmm. where we started, things started getting, you know, heated. And I said, okay, well, Mom, remember the last time we talked about this, we argued. So maybe not today, you know. And then every now and then we would come back and, you know, look, I read this article and this said this. And she was like, well, I read this and this said that. And I'm like, okay. So, you know, I have my friends whose beliefs and values align with mine in that way. And those are the ones I have these kind of conversation with. And then I think, you know, I pick my battles, you know.
Yeah. No, I absolutely hear that. And it's a journey that I'm still on for sure. Trying to balance that with my family that might not necessarily be politically or ideologically in line with what I have. But then, like you said, at the end of the day, we're still family, and we have this shared history and this share, and we still love each other so deeply, which I think is, you know, it's great to kind of remember. And you, your family, and correct me if I'm wrong, were Vietnamese refugees in Vietnam, right? Is that correct?
Yes. So my dad was in the South Vietnamese Air Force. And so after the war ended in 1975, anyone who served in the South Vietnam Army, Air Force, military, they had to go to what the communist Vietnamese called re-education camp, but we call them concentration camp because they were literally prison. And then there was a reparation program for anyone who stay in that camp for more than 3 years, they could legally immigrate to the U.S. So that's how my family was able to immigrate.
That must be really hard. I mean, did you all ever talk about that time that your dad spent in the concentration camps, or was it suppressed?
Not so much. I realize now that I think my parents, in their attempt to protect us, did not share a lot about the hardship of what they went through. Because, you know, it was heartbreaking. You know, I remember my mom later on, she said, you know, it's really expensive to go visit your relatives in these concentration camps. Like, you would sell a house and that would cover the cost of 3 trips. And that
was it. Wow.
Or my grandma, like when she go to visit my dad and she would make him food and she would hide money in the food. And that's how you would sneak money in so that he can have money to, you know, buy other things, because, you know, that's not something you could do openly.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So like these stories now, they come out, but growing up, you know, we live in communist Vietnam for 10 years. And so I think they were very careful about what they told us so that we don't go to school and say things and then get in trouble.
Mm-hmm. That way. Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's pretty amazing. I mean, it's really, again, it kind of hits home, because I'm finding too, at least with my mom and my aunt's generation, they have suppressed a lot of what happened to them. You know, in the 70s in the Philippines, it was a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. More or less, it was martial law. And so my uncle actually had disappeared. They don't know if they were taken by the rebels or if he was taken by the government. And and no one really knows the real story. And it wasn't until later on, you know, in my 30s when I started asking these questions. And it's very hush hush. Like, you know, no one really talks about it. They don't want to talk about it. And it comes in fragments, like you were saying, like you hear like these little tiny stories of like, this is what really happened. And you don't really know because you have this generation of in our parents' generation that were afraid. You know, they were afraid to say what was really going on because of what might happen to them. And I'm finding more and more I need to just start asking questions. But then again, it's the whole kind of conflict that I have with my aunt and my mom of that I want to know more, you know, tell me more. And they're like, no, we don't talk about that. And so I hope actually doing this podcast that some of the stories don't get lost just because they're not told. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. We in the Vietnamese community started a project a few years ago called the Vietnam Oral History Project. And we started interviewing some, you know, our parents' generation about their experience. And what I noticed, what we got several recordings from Vietnamese men, but I really want to interview the Vietnamese women as well, because when these men, you know, went to re-education prison, the woman stayed home and took care of the family. There's so many stories.
I love that.
This is Where Y'all Really From, a podcast from LPM, Louisville Public Media. Welcome back to Where Y'all Really From. Our guest is Uyên Nguyen. She's a Vietnamese-American social worker and therapist.
Well, after the Atlanta massacre, when six Asian-American women were murdered by a white male shooter, you wrote a powerful piece in Leo Weekly where you said, quote, "I am enraged for all the times I have felt the need to protect myself from men's bad days. The following day, I thought, now I should share something else, something lighter, more politically correct, more peaceful to balance out the fuck that I had so thoughtfully blipped out. I fought the urge to remain the pleasant model minority. Why must I be polite when I feel anything but?" End quote. Which, by the way, that's an amazing piece in the Leo Weekly. I remember reading that and I was like, this is amazing. This is exactly how I feel. Do you still feel this way now after the shooting has happened and everything has kind of, you know, stayed where it is?
Yes, I still feel that way. I think, you know, the pain and the anger, you know, that has subsided. But I feel more now than ever that I want to, you know, break out that model minority, you know, myth, because I really bought into it, you know, like, I remember being school, you know, you have to do your best, you have to make A's, and then you graduate with a good degree, make good money. And I think a lot of people in my Vietnamese and, you know, community really still buy into that, you know, minority, you know, frame. You know, you need to do good. And I remember even talking to someone in our community and saying, you know, that was a racist shooting. And he was like, well, no, nobody has, you know, the FBI hasn't made that claim yet. We can't say that. I'm like, really? You know?
It was absolutely racist. Really, yeah. I know exactly. And, you know, it was absolutely racist, targeted towards Asians. I mean, absolutely. And I absolutely hear you when you say that there's a lot of people in our communities that still buy into that myth, or that buy into that story that we should be a model minority. I mean, personally, like it's definitely has felt very heavy. I've had to, again, being surrounded by white people in high school and middle school and in college, I had to learn how to laugh it off. You know, that's how I adapted. Like, we had to laugh to survive. We had to laugh and or to hide our pain so that we could see another day, because we were just by ourselves. And so, and that really played into, like, this is the model minority. You know, you are the one that has to get good grades. You're not Black. So this racist joke shouldn't offend you, you know, kind of thing. And it's enraging. It's a lot of emotions there that have been bottled up. So, I mean, and you said in the Vietnamese community, there have been, you know, some of it is they're still buying into that. But have you seen any other type of reflection or these types of emotion among the AAPI community in Kentucky or in Louisville? Or is it just like one-off conversations? Is there a movement happening, an undertone of a movement where we need to really re-examine our stance as community and as individuals?
I think more and more people are speaking up, because previously, you know, like I was, you know, and you know, we smile it off, you know, oh, well, maybe it's not that big of a deal if someone make fun of our name, you know, but those little microaggressions add up. And so when I wrote that article, when I shared it on Facebook, a few of my Asian friends also shared it. And then I remember someone commented and saying, you know, I've not always spoken up when I saw something racist, but from now on I will. And that I think the person was not Asian. So more people are speaking up about their own pain, and that also motivates, you know, because of the connection. Like, if it's your friend being hurt, you're more likely to stand up. And so when I wrote that piece, more people are like, oh, well, I did not realize you've experienced these things. I did not realize other Asians have experienced these things. So I think there's a movement across the country, you know, not just in Kentucky. Like, I'm trying to educate myself more by, you know, reading more about Asian Americans' experience. I'm reading books and essays written by other Asian Americans. I did not realize how many Vietnamese Americans authors there are already publishing. I was like, oh man, this is wonderful.
No, I love that. I love that. There's definitely a reckoning happening, for sure. I mean, that, I don't know if you read Minor Feelings. You have? I'm reading through that right now, actually.
It's wonderful.
It's absolutely wonderful. And it's really the first time where I've really sat down and read an author who has very eloquently put into words the pain and the emotions that I've felt for so long, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think, like you said, more and more people are really diving into that and making their pain heard, which I think is very beautiful. But I think also there's like a process there that's also happening. I mean, do you think that we'll ever get to a point where Asian Americans will come to terms with their, you know, taking care of their mental health and really unpacking their race-based trauma?
I think so, and I hope so. I think it starts with the younger generation, like among my circle, the people I know who are seeking or have sought mental health care or younger generation. Older generation, like my parent generation, I have not seen a lot of that. I think the concept to them doesn't even exist. I remember trying to find a Vietnamese word to translate what I do for a living. And that's difficult because it's not a common thing.
Oh, wow.
I think the language barrier and the cultural barrier are huge. And also I think right now there are not a lot of providers, mental health providers, who are Asians. And I think that as that grows, that will help. I remember there was an online directory that was started, I don't know when, but around recently. And it lists all their Asian, or as you know, Asian providers in different states. And in Kentucky, there is none.
Yep. Yes, I'm shaking my head yes, because I've been on that directory actually trying to find an Asian American therapist, and there wasn't any, you know. And I think race-based trauma is definitely up and coming in terms of a wonderful way of unpacking trauma across marginalized groups. But there's something about the Asian American experience too that I feel like we need to dive deeper into as a community and as individuals. And I don't know where to start. Like, you tell me, are you taking patients recently?
Anybody who's a patient of our family health centers can see me. I can't say anything about the clients I see, but I do know that the stigma is there, and the mentality is that you keep things within your family, right? So some of the stuff I'm sharing today, probably I should have shared, you know, according to my family, I shouldn't have shared them, but it's that, right? You go to your family, you keep things hidden, you know. Why do you need to go talk to strangers when you have us? It's that mentality. I think Vietnamese is very collective culture, right? So it's a collective. But you say something about you that reflect on your family, that reflect on all Vietnamese. So there's also that need to hide and to not show that we're vulnerable, which is why I appreciate, you know, Kathy Park Hong book so much, because she's so vulnerable and so honest about her experience as an Asian American person. So I recommend that book to everyone.
Yes. And you do think we're going to get to a point for the younger, especially for younger Asian Americans, who will lean outside of those family centered values? Or you think it might just, do you think that you've said that movement is happening with the younger generation. Do you think that will sustain, or will the family centered values kind of trump that?
I think people will eventually, but move toward those who they feel that they have close connections with. So like for me, like I have two friends whom I call sisters, and they're not my sister, but they are like my sisters to me, because we share values, we share beliefs, we share experience, we support each other, just like family members do. And we learn from each other. And I think as the younger generation grow up, they go to college, they have that college experience, that education, I think there will be a cultural shift in that way. I hope, we can only hope, you know, hope will sustain us.
Yes, no, absolutely. So I do like to end each episode with lightning round questions. Are you ready for them?
Okay.
What's your superpower?
I'm pretty good at seeing, I used to say the brighter side of things, but I also know that there's that toxic positivity. So it's always, you know, you don't always have to see the brighter side of things, but I do try to see the other side of things. And I think it's important in trying to bridge connection with someone who's very different from you.
Very much needed nowadays. Favorite song to jam to?
I have one favorite musician, Trịnh Công Sơn. He's a Vietnamese musician and composer. And he has a song called "Để Gió Cuốn Đi." It means to be swept away by the wind. And the lyrics goes, in this life, you need to have a heart so that can be swept away by the wind. So very whimsical. Oh,
that's so beautiful, though. That's so beautiful. What's your favorite comfort food?
I love all kinds of soup. When I was younger, every time I come home after a long travel, my mom would always ask what I want to eat. And I always say, like, I wanted this sup mang kua, which is like this crab seafood soup that she would make. So,
that sounds delicious.
Yeah.
That sounds
She's a really good cook.
What's the most Kentucky thing you do?
I think every time I go to a restaurant, if there's something on the menu, like some food that has bourbon flavor or bourbon in it, I would try it. So that's probably, the most Kentucky thing I do.
Oh, that's so funny. Well, thank you so much for being here today and opening up and sharing all your experiences and your insights. And I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Where Y'all Really From is created by Dan Wu, Charlene Buckles, Nima Kulkarni, and May Suramek, and hosted by Dan and Charlene. Our show is edited by Alex Cooper, and our music is by Kojin Toshiro. Leanne Gann did our graphic design. Where Y'all Really From is part of the Louisville Public Media Podcast Incubator, with support from the Community Foundation of Louisville, Podchaser, Rankings.io, and the Eye Care Institute's Butchertown Clinical Trials. Our executive producer is Laura Ellis. For more information and to keep in touch, visit whereyallreallyfrom.org.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.